This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done pretty incredible things for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So often, we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's program is going to be a little different. Each one of the hundreds of veterans I've interviewed over the years has left me feeling privileged for that opportunity. But every once in a while, we hear from a veteran whose name or voice might be familiar. On April 5th, Lon Simmons passed away at the age of 91. If you grew up in California, especially the Bay Area, you definitely heard his voice a time or two, and his legacy stretched well beyond the Giants and 49ers and A's. He is in the Broadcasters Wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. He spent much of his later years on his beloved Maui. And as we're going to hear, he traveled the world with the Coast Guard during World War II. Lon had a booming voice, the quickest of wits, a self-deprecating style, and that wasn't all an act. He really was a humble man, and he was gracious enough to come on Hometown Heroes with me in February of 2012. And I thought, as a tribute to Lon and his legacy, that we could revisit some of that conversation this week, a discussion that started with one of his most fondly remembered play-by-play calls, one of the most improbable and electrifying plays in NFL history.
Back to throw. In trouble. He's going to be sacked. No, gets away. He runs. Gets away again. Goes to the 40. Gets away again. To the 35. Cuts back at the 30. To the 20. The 15. The 10. He dives. Touchdown, 49ers. Young is exhausted. He stumbled as he got to the 2. He could barely move. He dived into the end zone. And the 49ers have taken the lead with 158, a 49-yard touchdown run by Steve Young.
I remember it like it was yesterday. I was riding my bike to an evening church service in my hometown of Los Banos and almost ran into oncoming traffic because of that incredible call and that incredible moment. Lon Simmons, the guy behind that call. Lon, do you get tired of hearing people play back all your calls from all the years of sports announcing?
No, not really. I don't hear them all when they get played back, but what we used to do when I was first with the Giants and the 49ers, all we used to record, tape everything, and then if a player made a great play, we would single that out, put it together, and give it to them as a tape that they kept. And a lot of the ball players from the past came back to me and say, oh, yeah, I've still got that tape, and I listen to it every once in a while. When I'm feeling low, I listen to it, and I feel good about what I did then. It's a good thing to for the players especially, to remember or look back and see how what they did at that time was recognized over the air. But with me and Steve Young, it turned out, I told Steve later when I talked to him, I said, you know, we both ran out of gas at about the same time.
But you both put points on the board, and I think that call, as someone who tries to do what you did for so many years for a living, I think what you really did was you captured the sheer incredulity of that call. No one saw that play coming, and it really was remarkable that he was able to do what he did. And I think you could hear that in your voice, that you were as surprised as anyone else.
Well, I was, because it looked definitely like he was going to be sacked. He was surrounded, and he got out. The only thing that I missed, and I regretted that I missed, was a comeback block by Randy Cross in the middle of that run that helped save the day, too, because he certainly should have been credited as, at least partially as much as Steve was.
Well, you've given him the credit now, so that's taken care of. And long before legions of fans were listening to you on the airwaves, the radio was instrumental in spreading the news of the attack that drew America into World War II. You grew up in Southern California. Do you remember where you were on December 7th, 1941, and how you found out the Japanese had attacked?
I remember December 7th because Bill Thompson and I and some of my other pals had gone to the beach on that day. And we came back, and there were newspapers out with the headlines about the Pearl Harbor attack. So that was the first time that I was aware of that. Well, naturally, from that point on, things changed a great deal, but I wasn't able to get into the service until the end of 1942. What I did is a group of us, well, Bill Thompson and another friend of ours, Dick Thornhill, we decided we had all gone in to try to sign up. In fact, I'd gone in to sign up with the Air Force. Something happened that I didn't get a chance to sign up. But anyway, I went. We went to Glendale College because it was the spring, and we thought, well, let's go to Glendale and play baseball. Mm-hmm. So the three of us went, and there were about five or six other guys, and it turned out to be that we had about 12 that made up a team at Glendale College. And we played. We won the Southern California Championship there and lost only one game. And that one game, I lost. We had two pitchers, me and a fellow by the name of Jim Smith, and I lost the game. I pitched against the Los Angeles team in the second game. We beat them in the first game earlier in the year, and then in the second game, I lost in 13 innings. Bill and Dick and I worked for the Bank of America, and we worked at the clearinghouse. And what would happen, we had to go in at night and work. So we'd go to school in the morning and daytime, practice baseball or play baseball games in the afternoon, and then go in and go to work. Well, the night before we played L.A. City College in this game that I lost, we worked all night long. We didn't get off work till 6 in the morning. And so we came back to Bill's house and then went over to play the game, and naturally it had to go 13 innings, and in the 13th inning they scored a couple of runs against me and we lost 3-1. That was that situation, and we then tried to sign up again, and they were having so much trouble that even after we were signed up, they couldn't call us because they were having so much difficulty processing all the people that were going into the service.
Right.
And we were sort of on the tail end. But we went and worked for the shipyards and played baseball for the shipyard team and worked in the shipyards and worked graveyard, naturally, and then eventually got into the service.
Well, and I'm sure your dream, as you're pitching 13-inning ball games and pitching for a team that only lost that one game, you had aspirations of playing baseball beyond that. And I'm curious, just from a baseball standpoint, as I think back on that time, 70 years ago, really, West Coast baseball at the major league level didn't exist. So
no, it was Pacific Coast League golf. But what happened is at the end of the year at Glendale, Rod Dedeau, the USC coach, see, I grew up an avid USC fan. From the time I was about 4 years old, I remember listening to their game. Anyway, at the end of our baseball season, Rod Dedeau offered Ken McBride, our catcher, and me a scholarship to USC. And you talk about it's something that lights up your eyes, but already we, Bill and Dick and I had decided to go in the service, so I didn't take it, but Ken McBride did. So flash ahead to 1944 when I was on the LST. We had received mail. We picked up mail various places. I can't even remember how we got it, but we got this mail, and in it was a Life magazine. And the Life magazine said the life of a V-12 or whatever they called them, student. And it showed Ken McBride, and he was sitting at a table, and there were about 10 USC co-eds lined up around him. And I said, my God, how did I make this bad a mistake? But that was funny that he was there. But going still farther ahead, when I was doing Fresno State sports, we came to play University of Hawaii, and I met Ken at the airport, and he was still in the Marines, because after you finished your college, you had to go into the service for, I think, a limited time, maybe 4 years, I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, he was still in the Marines. He was a captain of the Marines, and I said, well, this is the only time I'm not jealous of you.
Well, I don't blame you back in the time to open up a magazine and see that and wonder what could have been. What was the Coast Guard like for you? And you went in with a couple of buddies, but were you able to stick with those buddies throughout your time in the Coast Guard?
No. We all signed up together, and we were all sent in different directions. And at that time, the military tried to keep good friends and relatives separated. They didn't want you to be in situations, if they were dire situations where either that many people from a family would be killed or injured in the same action, or they didn't want that to affect how you reacted in those situations. So we were separated. And the funny part was how we joined the Coast Guard was unbelievable. I don't know how we did it, because we were all thinking about first getting in the Naval Air Force, and that didn't work out. And then we were, I don't know what we were thinking. Then we saw this sign that said, not Uncle Sam wants you, but the Coast Guard wants you. And it showed this PT boat and everything. So we thought, well, heck, let's try that. So we went down there, and they were more than happy to take us in. But we still had to wait after we signed up before we were called into service. And it was several months, and so we continued working at the shipyards during that time.
Was there any part of that where you thought, you know, I really want to play baseball, and going into the service is going to interrupt my baseball career?
No, I didn't think about that then. I didn't give it one thought. I knew that I was going into the service. I felt I wanted to go into the service. I felt that's where I should be. And I don't know why I felt that the Coast Guard was the place I was supposed to be, but it turned out that. And naturally, I had to take a lot of flack from people from the Navy and the Marines because of the shield on the arm. That, what's that for? And they would say, well, that's because they're shallow water sailors. And I said, well, some of the shallow water I got into was pretty deep. But anyway, the thing is that I never gave it another thought about baseball. And in the service, I was in for about, I don't know, 3.5 years or more. In that service, I never played any baseball. I played catch a couple of times. And on the LST, when we dump off the large landing craft that we had on the front, the deck would be fairly clear. So I had a buddy there, and we had baseball and a big, what do you call them, the big weighted...
Like a medicine ball or something, huh?
Medicine ball, yeah. Okay, well, we had those on there. So I used to play catch with him, but when the ship... I'd be throwing to him, but when the ship would go down, the ball would go right over his head out in the ocean. And so one day I was up on wheel watch, and the officer of the deck said to me, he wasn't a great baseball fan, but he says, the guys had the medicine ball on the deck. And he said, well, he says, at least, he says, you've lost all the baseballs and whatever else we had. I guess we had a football, too, and we lost that. He says, but that's one thing we won't lose. And as he said that, the guy threw the medicine ball at another guy, and the ship took a roll, and it hit the deck and rolled into the water. So that was the end of his story right there.
Classic. And I think we all just saw it unfolding in our imaginations. You know, you're pretty good at telling us which way that ball is bouncing. Was that an adjustment for you, civilian life, to the Coast Guard?
The first shock I had was getting on the train in Los Angeles, leaving home for the first time, and going, and I think it took us something like 16 hours to get to Alameda.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get off the train, and it's the middle of the night. We get off the train, and this boat is there, and he says, all right, you guys, line up, and now we go in and get in the barracks, and they issue us some equipment and stuff, and I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? Where's my bed? And so that was sort of an introduction. But then you go through boot camp, and it was pretty strenuous. Not as strenuous, I don't imagine, as the Army or the Marines, but it was certainly a strenuous camp. We had incidents there where you talk about being hazed and stuff, that occurred, that the bosuns were tough guys, and they made you do things that ordinarily you wouldn't want to do or probably shouldn't do.
You wouldn't be the first guy I'd pick on, though.
Well, I didn't know. Are you going to fight back?
I guess not, but you had to be one of the bigger guys.
I spent a great deal of my time in the service getting out of things. I mean, when I went on a ship, I worked myself to death the first few weeks. I volunteered for everything. I did everything. And so I became a guy that they thought, well, here's somebody that really does everything. Then later on, they were appointing guys to do things, and I wouldn't be around. And I wouldn't be called because they weren't worried about me. They knew I was going to be working anyway. The guys used to get on me about that. And I said, well, it's just how you act. You tried to get out of everything right away. I did everything right away and waited to get out of it until they thought I was a really good sailor.
I think there are some life lessons there in that story.
I think one of the things that I think, looking back on my career in the service, that we won the war despite me.
Well, you know, that's, I think, one of the things that has endeared you to so many is you've always been so self-deprecating, and you come up with some great lines that we've heard over the years, and there's another one of them. But I want to hear about some of that action. If you spend 3.5 years in the Coast Guard, I'm sure not every day was the same. Were there ever days and places that you thought, you know what, I wonder what Ken McWright's doing right now, and am I ever going to get back into a situation like that?
You know, honestly, as I look back, probably it seems better than I felt at the time. But one of the things I had in my mind, you talk about baseball, I used to look at the other guys on the ship and feel sorry for them because I knew what I was going to do when I got back.
Mm.
I was going to play professional baseball. That was my idea. I always felt I was going to be a major league pitcher. As it turned out, the only reason I didn't become a major league pitcher was because of the hitters. But I always felt that's what I was going to do. So I had that idea. And we had, you know, doing all these things that we did, that we had to do, that was GI or whatever we did, but we had fun in between. We had times when we didn't look at being in the service as a bad thing. We looked at it as being in the service, that's where we were supposed to be. I mean, our country was at war. Where were we supposed to be?
Makes sense to me. That's the familiar voice of Lon Simmons, the legendary sports announcer who died April 5th at the age of 91. It's time for us to take a break, but we'll explore more of Lon's Coast Guard experiences in World War II when we come back. Maybe you'll hear another one of his signature calls along the way, and we're going to discuss that broadcasting career before we're done here as well. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a tribute to Hall of Fame sports announcer Lon Simmons, who died April 5th at the age of 91. We heard how he ended up in the Coast Guard. He would be on an LST for the invasion of Saipan, but his 3.5 years in uniform also included some time aboard a Coast Guard cutter in Hawaii.
So we were on that and took sub-patrol around the islands. And so we traveled to most all the islands in Hawaii. And then we would either come into Pearl Harbor to dock or to Honolulu to dock. Mm-hmm. So our job there was to basically just keep the ship running and do our chores and stand watch and stand wheel watch and do normal ship duties. But there were occasions, like Navy used to do bombing on Hualavi here, and they needed equipment to build structures that they were going to bomb. So on the cutter, we had a pulling boat, single bank, that we used. So we went over, we had to go over to Hualavi, and we had all this equipment that we were carrying over there, and we had to take it ashore on our pulling boat. So it was just like surfing. We had to go through the surf to get to the sand, and the one time we had to take us into the sand, and we'd get off, pull the boat up on there and take the equipment off. And then we would go back, and we'd have to run out through the breakers and all running, pushing the boat, and get out there and then jump in the boat and just grab the paddle and start paddling so we could get through the break like you're trying to get out if you're going out to ride a surfboard in. But the one day coming in, we breached, the boat flipped completely over and threw us all out of the boat, and our oar locks were still in the gunwale, and the boat came down and hit me on the gunwale hit me on the head. And fortunately, I was in deep enough water, and it was a pretty heavy boat, and it hit me and knocked me down deeper in the water, but it didn't knock me out, or it didn't kill me, or it didn't crush me. I just went down and then came back up. But fortunately, those oar locks were still in there. If one of those had hit me in the head, it certainly would have done some damage. And then one of the members of the crew wasn't thrown out, but he was up in the bow of the boat, and the boat was still tipped over, and he just came up on the beach plowing sand with his hands. And so that was quite an experience. But it was a fun job running out through the waves, pretending we were surfers getting out there. So it was an interesting incident. We had many of those where there were interesting things that we did. And then one time we had a skipper who was sort of a character, and we had a, what was it called? The only armament we had on the boat was a small cannon. Uh-huh. And so now we're out on patrol, and we flash identification numbers at night to the ship that we see, and it doesn't return the call. So our skipper figures, well, that's an enemy craft out there. So he sends us all to general quarters. We take the cover off the gun, and we're getting ready to fire at the ship. And fortunately, they returned the call finally, and it was a U.S. destroyer.
Ooh.
And if we'd have fired one little round, we would have been blown completely out of the water. But it was funny because he was really gung-ho. He thought that was a Japanese ship, and we were going to blow it away.
You know, and these are the stories that I get a kick out of, and I think back, every guy that I've had on this show, every World War II veteran can point to a moment where if things go a little differently, he's not here talking to me. And so many of our great sports figures had the same kind of stories. John Wooden was destined to be on the USS Franklin and would have been kamikazed if he didn't have a knee injury right before he was supposed to go over. And for you, I guess, if you got hit on the head a little harder by that ship, or if that other one, if the destroyer hadn't finally returned that communication, then you wouldn't have had the chance to call all those great players.
But the thing is that then when we went on the LST, we were all tied up in Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
28 LSTs were tied up, all loaded with troops and ammunition and big landing boats on our deck. And there was some welding going on one of the ships, and it caused an explosion.
Mm.
Now everything started blowing up. Ships started catching on fire. We had to chop lines to get out, and some of the troops that were on the ships panicked and were diving over the side into the water instead of staying on the ship.
Like, that's going to be safer, huh?
And then they're now in the water where these ships are all coming out trying to get out of the place where we were to get to a safe area, and they were hit by the ships, and some of the ships were badly damaged, and nothing was ever mentioned about it.
Right.
But because of the fact that we were getting ready to go to Saipan, which we did, but they didn't want any mention of this happening because they didn't want any news to get the Japanese. I'm sure the Japanese knew about it as soon as it happened, but that was a thing that was never reported happened. But
well, there
it
were
was,
a lot of
it
those.
Was an amazing thing with ships blowing up and ammunition going off and everything. And our captain was blown right off the deck, onto the deck, off of the wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a weird, wild thing, but we got it back together and eventually got on our way and went to Saipan.
And I guess you had to kind of stand by and watch helplessly through all of that, huh?
Well, there was not much you could do except try to get the ship untied from the other. We were all tied together.
Right.
And chop the lines and get out, and nothing we could do except the engineers and stuff had to start the engines and get those going. We were just going to get out of there. I was running my buddy and I, we had two personnel landing barges on the LST, and he and I ran those. That was our means of transportation when we were in the harbor, and it was our means of taking the troops ashore when we were in a place where they had to land.
So how many landings did you participate in
just
that
one?
Way?
Just
at Saipan?
When we were on the beach, the Japanese were leaving Saipan to get over to Tinian. And that's where they had the royal troops, the supposedly the top troops in Japan, were on Tinian. And the Japanese on Saipan were coming out at night in rubber boats and everything else that they had to get across the Tinian. And they were going behind us, all of which were on the beach. And then sometimes as they'd go by, they'd have machine guns or something, they'd shoot up the ship, so we had to be on watch all the time. And then Tinian, they were firing big guns at us, but they couldn't quite reach us. They were just falling short of us, so we were never hit by any of them. My buddy and I were on our landing barges that we took. We went around to all the other ships. We would go in and pick people up off the beach and take them to the ships that they'd come in on, either for medical attention or if they were being relieved there. So we were traveling around doing that and taking supplies off some of the ships and everything. So that was our tour of duty there when the ship was on the beach.
Was it difficult emotionally to see these wounded soldiers that you're taking back to ships?
Oh, yeah. I picked up one fellow one day who was... He had been on the opening day of invasion. This was about 5 or 6 days later, and he still thought he wasn't wounded, but he was just completely shocked. He still thought it was D-Day on the island. He still thought it was the first day that it came on.
Wow.
And there were others. See, what happened there at Saipan, too, is they would dig foxholes, and the troops would go in the foxholes at night, but many of the Japanese soldiers could speak English, and they would... at night would sneak over and come over to one of these foxholes and say something about, hey, buddy, what you and jump into the foxhole with the guy, and the guy would think it was an American soldier, and they'd kill the guys in the foxhole. And so that was a treacherous thing. So they really had a tough job. I never considered having a tough job being on that ship when we're on the beach, because we said goodbye to the guys, and they had to go out there and take the majority of the problems. The ship that I was off, and my buddy and I were really upset about it, because when we came back, it was an old LST, and we thought, well, we'll take our 30 days leave, and then we'll come back and get on a new LST, and it'll go to another place. Well, they took our old LST and went to the Philippines, and that's where we'd wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
And so they got to go to the Philippines, and we did. So that was upsetting. Talk about, we were in and we wanted to get in all the action we could, because we felt that was the only way that we were really helping anything.
Did you ever think you might not make it home?
You know, you don't think about those things. I mean, if you think about them, if you think you're going to survive whatever happens. I never felt that. I remember when we were going to Saipan, and we had truck was one of the big bases of the Japanese, and this entire flight of Japanese bombers came over us. And here we had this hole, and the biggest guns we had were destroyers that were escorting us. They could have dropped bombs without impunity because we couldn't have reached them.
Mm-hmm.
They just flew right over us and didn't do anything. And they had to be able to see us. So, I don't know, things just sort of worked out for me not to get killed, I guess.
We're all thankful for that. For a lot of reasons.
I don't know how thankful we have to be. There are a lot of people that couldn't give thanks because they were killed doing what they had to do and what they were supposed to do. And I never felt that my duty was a chore. I felt it was an obligation, and an obligation that I accepted and that I certainly didn't resent. I went from the South Pacific up to the Aleutians.
Burr.
So there went my tan. But I was on the Aleutians, and I was on a ship for a while up there, and then I was on a Loran station in an isolated station in the Aleutians.
And what time of year was it? What was the weather like up there?
It was cold. It was windy, and it was snowy. We were up on a cliff, and we had to get our supplies from the main town on Attu. We were on this isolated station. We had just a little inlet where we could get a boat out and get a boat in, but the weather had to be perfect. So when we wanted, a ship would come over and bring the supplies, and we'd have to row out and get the supplies. But we could only do it if the weather was fine, if there wasn't big waves coming into this little inlet, because it was all rocky around there. So anyway, this one day we went out to get supplies from the ship in our pulling boat, and And we got out there, and now we get the supplies, and we come back in, and a storm came up, as it was wont to do. There was a point that we had to come around. Well, the weather was going so that we weren't making much yardage in our pulling boat trying to get back over where we could get into our inlet. And it started filling with water, and we didn't have anything to bail with. So the bosun says, well, we better turn around and go back. So we turned around and rowed back to the ship, and they dropped a rope ladder over the side. And we all grabbed on the rope ladder just to see our little boat start sinking down into the water. So they had to get us another boat, and we had to wait for a while before we could get back to our base. And then we heard about the atomic bomb over there, too. And we were all interested in what that was. Marveled at what a piece of destruction it was. So at the station where we were up on the Aleutian, there was an equipment set where the Army had been there before, and they had skis and toboggans. And so we decided we were going to have a toboggan race. So we went up, and we're going up. This hill behind us was really steep. When we came down, at the bottom of the hill was where our oil drums were in the snow, and then at the end of that is the cliff that you went over down in the ocean. So what we had to do is when we came down the hill, this big steep hill, and it was so steep that when you got up towards the top of it, you couldn't walk, you had to crawl up to the top of it. So then we'd get on these toboggans and come down. When you got down at the bottom, you had to jump off and hope that the toboggan ran into something. Because if you happen to miss everything, you were going to go over the cliff. Well, we came to our first test run where we were going to have a race. There were three of us. Our first test run is we're going up. There was a sawhorse that the leg of the sawhorse was sticking up out of the snow. And as we walked by it, the guy says, hey, we shouldn't come down here. We're probably going to hit that. And I said, heck, it's right in the middle of a big mountain. How are we ever going to hit this? So down we come. And there were four of us in the toboggan, and when we hit this arm, the toboggan naturally flipped over. The front stopped, and the back kept on. Well, the first guy went a little way. The second guy went farther. The third guy was me, and I went farther, and the fourth guy went farther. But I was hitting on my head and then my feet. I couldn't stop. I mean, I was going, just bouncing on my feet and then hitting on my head and then on my feet. Darn near killed my back. And but that was one of our exciting things there. And then what we did is we found some hydrogen peroxide. And so we said, we were checking this stuff. And we said, well, what is hydrogen peroxide for? And the guy says, well, you can dye, you can bleach your hair with it. So this other guy and I said, hey, that's great. Let's bleach our hair. Well, we bleached our hair, and I swear it wasn't a week after we bleached our hair that I got my papers to be discharged. And I had, but my hair had not turned blonde, it had turned green. So I had to shave off all my hair because bleaching my hair had turned it green rather than blonde. And so I didn't think it would be a good idea to fly back for discharge with green hair.
Although, you know, that might have worked out for the years that Lon spent announcing the Oakland A's games in that green and gold. When our tribute to the late Lon Simmons continues, we're going to hear how his major league dreams migrated from the mound to the booth. And you can listen to the full-length original interviews at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating today the life of Lon Simmons, the longtime Giants, 49ers, and A's announcer. You might not know that sports announcing is my main job. I'm blessed to call events nationally on ESPN from time to time, and I'm privileged to be the radio voice of the Fresno State Bulldogs for football, basketball, and baseball. 60 years ago, that's exactly what Lon Simmons was doing. We've heard about his early baseball exploits and his time in the Coast Guard, and let's pick it up with his return home to Southern California at age 23 after 3.5 years serving in World War II.
Rod Dato at USC used to always
play Douglas Brothers semi-pro team. They play them two games, one at Bovard Field and one at Griffith Park. And so Douglas Brothers had played USC for years. They never had beaten them. So I come back, and so they, I hadn't, as I say, I'd only thrown the ball a couple of times in almost 4 years.
Thrown it off
and
the
so
ship,
So I come back, and they asked me if I could come and pitch for them. They were playing USC and Bovard Field. So I wanted to see Rod Dedeaux, so I said, okay, I'll go over. I pitched a complete game against USC. I think we beat them like 14-6 or 7 or something. I didn't pitch a flawless game, but I must have thrown 200 pitches, and I pitched the entire game. That was on a Saturday. Well, they were playing them the next Saturday at Griffith Park. The Douglas brothers were so happy they won that game and said, well, you got to come back and pitch the next one. So I didn't throw any more between that game and the next Saturday, and I went back and pitched the next Saturday against USC, and I pitched a two-hit shutout against them. So I'd pitched 18 innings in a week, and I don't know how many pitches, not too many in the two-hitter. So then the scout that I'd known before, he wanted to send me back to Terre Haute and said that send me back there to the field. And he said, you don't have to. I said, I don't want to sign. I want to go to school and all this sort of stuff. Well, you don't have to sign. So he sent me back there. And so I thought, well, it'll be a nice trip. I'll go back there. So I went back there, and I worked out with him. And I wasn't in condition to pitch. And so they signed me. Now they decided, and so Mr. Stupid, they had offered me $1,000. I thought, I can't sign for $1,000. $1,000 was quite a bit then. But instead of saying $25,000, I said, well, you'd have to give me $2,500, which seemed like a lot to me. Well, they did. So they signed me. So that night I went out, and the first night that I signed, I pitched to three guys and struck them out in the first inning. The second inning, I worked up in my first pitch that I threw to the next hitter. I felt this sharp pain in the back of my shoulder across the big shoulder blade. And so I finished the inning, got out of the inning. But my shoulder, a big knot, cut up over his shoulder. And so I told him, I said, I've hurt my shoulder. And they were paying my bonus $500 a week. So they weren't going to let me stop pitching.
Right.
So I pitched with that, and they wouldn't let me go to the doctor. So they wouldn't send me to the team doctor. But I had this knot that came up. So I started a couple of games and certainly wasn't pitching very well. And so finally, when I came back from a road trip, I went to the doctor myself. And he said, oh, you just got a cold in your arm. It's all right. Well, I started pitching. What I did is I started pitching to keep the pain out of my shoulder. I started putting my elbow in, so I was pitching a different motion. And then I really hurt my shoulder, and I assume I got the rotator cuff. They didn't know anything about rotator cuff. But
sounds about right.
But anyway, I got so I could hardly throw the ball at all, so they released me, so they didn't have to pay me any more money. So then I came back, and the fabulous Douglas brothers, I came back, and they wanted me to pitch. So I said, okay, I'll try. Well, I pitched in the game, and the scout that had sent me back there, I don't know what word he got from him, but probably not very good word. I pitched the game, pitched a complete game, and pitched like hell. And the scout, about four innings in, got up and left because he thought I was BSing about. But after that game, I could not. It was just I pitched one game and won the game, and I pitched against some guys that I played against in college and semi-pro ball and stuff. And I saw them that night after the game, and I beat them. And they said, God, we kept waiting for you. You beat us with that changeup. We kept waiting for you to throw that fastball. And I said, man, that was my fastball. but it was interesting. I tried to pitch a lot after that and just never would heal up. It never would be. But I played fast pitch softball for a couple of years. Bill Thompson was the manager of the team for Technicolor. And I played center field for him, and I could throw the softball from center field.
Huh.
And throw it around, and it didn't bother me, but I could not throw the baseball.
Well, I guess in retrospect, it's a good thing, because if you had, then we wouldn't have had you on the airwaves all these years to listen to.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have been on the airwaves, and I probably wouldn't have made the big leagues anyway. So, but with the Philadelphia chain, then, you went from Terre Haute, where I was, to either A-ball or you went to Philadelphia. And our catcher, that was Dan LaPata, that was there, he went from Terre Haute directly to Philadelphia and played for quite a few years.
How did you end up getting into broadcasting. How did you make that decision, and how did that fall into place for you?
Well, it's a long story, and I'll just hit it briefly. I took journalism in high school, and I had written for the local paper, and so I was working as a carpenter. I was working in construction, and I was not a very good carpenter. I was just a construction carpenter, and it didn't suit me at all, and I didn't see how I was going to spend the rest of my life doing that. It's a very noble profession, but it wasn't a very noble one for me because I wasn't very good at it. And so anyway, my wife, I don't know how we got to talking. She said, well, why don't you go see about getting a newspaper job? So I went to the Burbank newspaper, which I'd written things for when I was in high school, and asked them if I could get a job. And they said, well, you can't do sports because we have two guys on the sports scene here, and that's all we had room for. So we could put you on as the, what do they call it, where you go out and write about parties and stuff.
The entertainment scene or something.
Yeah, something like that. I said, no, I can't handle that. So my wife said, well, you know, you talk, you've got a good voice, so why don't you, maybe you could get in radio. So we found, and there was a radio, you could go to a radio school, and they would teach, you had to get a first-class ticket. They would teach you the idea of radio mechanically and also help you broadcasting. So I went to that, and I worked as a carpenter the daytime, and I went to the school at night three times a week. Well, it became obvious after I was there for a while that I wasn't going to learn anything about electricity that I could be an engineer, and I had to pass the test. They had a question and answer book. So I memorized the book. And I went and took the test and passed the first-class test. And you had to make schematic drawings, but if you passed the written part, you could pass enough to get your license. So I didn't do any of the schematics because I had no idea what they were, but I answered all the questions on the other part of it and got 80% or something, which was enough to get my first-class ticket. So then I could go to a small station. If you could speak English and you had a license, you could get a job in a lot of small stations. They needed people. I got one at Elko, Nevada, and I talked to the guy, and he said, well, after talking to you, you've got the first-class license, right? And I said, yeah. Well, he said 50% is not bad. You don't speak English very well. And so I got the job up there, and I worked there for just a little over a month. I came back because I had been promised a job in Sacramento, which I wasn't smart enough to know that I couldn't handle. And so when they opened the station, they didn't offer me a job. So I came back, went to work for a contractor for a while, and then I got a thing where there was an opening in Yuba City, Marysville. So I called there, and I got that. And when I got that call, I said, okay, guys, here's the toolbox. You can take my tools. I'm not going to use them ever again. So I gave away my tools, and I went to Marysville, and that's where I started. And I did sports for nothing. I did a DJ job and sports for nothing, and then that got me where I could do football and baseball and basketball. And then I got the chance to go to Fresno, where I strictly did sports, and then I got a chance to go to San Francisco, and that's the way it went.
And what was Fresno like when you got here? What was that, about 1954?
No, 1953. It was, you know, wasn't like it is now. It wasn't that big or that many freeways or anything. It was a fun time. It was a good place. KMJ, McClatchy had KMJ and had a TV station and had the newspaper. So it was a pretty good outfit to work for.
And, you know, two of my favorite voices of all time would be yours and Jack Hanna's. Jack is still here. He tours the world singing with the Sons of San Joaquin.
Oh, yeah. Jack was playing pitching for Fresno State when I broadcast the game.
That's why I brought it up. What do you remember about him?
He was something. He could throw it. And they went up to play USC in the playoffs up in Oregon. And
right.
I couldn't go up there. I had to recreate it. But Jack pitched the game up there. And he was so sure that he was going to beat USC that he was crying when he finished. He was so into it. And he did. He beat them. But they lost other game or something. But he beat USC anyway in one of the playoff games.
And you were back here in Fresno recreating that game. This is something that's always fascinated me. Because I love announcing a baseball game, but I can see it. To announce a game that you can't see and you're dependent on a little piece of paper coming across this ticker machine, How did you do that? How did you come up with the creativity to make that sound like you were actually there?
Well, the thing about that was that a lot of guys use sound effects and everything. I didn't use sound effects, but I just announced it like I was at the game. You would get the information on the ticker about ball one, strike one, or fly ball to right. Then in one inning, I got two out. There was a runner on, and I got two outs, and they didn't send me to third out.
So how'd you kill time?
Now I realized that when I started the next inning, I was going to have a batter come up. Now, if the guy had been thrown out on the bases, the same batter would be up there. If he made an out, the next batter would be up. So I had to take a choice, and I guessed right. I said he made an out, and so I got through that anyway.
I'm sure you've heard the famous story about President Reagan and his ticker tape scenario where he just had the same batter foul off pitch after pitch until the ticker started up again?
Yeah. Well, I did that I wasn't doing the games at Marysville. We had Les Kiter used to do the recreation of the Major League games from San Francisco, and we took it. We had the big discs that were recording, and so I had to put it on record and record the first part of it while I was doing a newscast. Then I would switch to another thing and start playing back the first one after I got off the newscast. Well, those big things, they didn't have much of a break on them. When you roll it back, you could only roll it back at one speed, and when you stopped it, they'd break. So each time that first one would break, I'd have to splice it, and so I'd go on the air and say there was a rain delay. They had more rain delays than they knew in the major leagues that year, because each day I had to splice that tape before I could start the broadcast. That was it. And then I even recreated a basketball game. But the guy sent me through. I found out the guy was sending me through six names instead of five for one team. So I finally had to let one of them go.
Wow. I don't know that I could ever do that, to get two words and turn it into a whole paragraph on the air and a whole picturesque description of what's happening. That takes a special skill.
Well, I don't know how good I did it. I just did it. But then you probably had to broadcast the Horned-Toed Derby either. I had to broadcast that.
Out in Kalinga?
Yeah. I broadcast that. And unfortunately, Randy Elliott, who was doing the color for me, so to speak, you had to be very careful about making a spoonerism out of Horned-Toed Derby.
Oh, I imagine, yeah.
And Ramsey was interviewing the pastor who was the head of the parade. Ramsey is talking to him, and he's going to set really slow for him, and you can cut this out if you want. But he said, "We're very happy, Reverend, to have you here at the annual Horned-Toed Derby." It was interesting. You learned it. Well, Al Michaels had to do arm wrestling to get his career kicked up. So you have to do little things along the way, and you worked your way through different situations too.
Well, I got to meet Marty Glickman one time when I was a student at Syracuse, and I never forget him telling me, and for people who don't know, Marty Glickman kind of invented basketball play-by-play and was one of the early sportscasters. And he said, "Hey, I don't care if you're announcing the World Marbles Championship or the National Spelling Bee, you got to approach it the same way." And I've been fortunate enough to do the National Spelling Bee a few times, so I always remember Marty's words.
But that's what you have to do. If you're going to do it, you have to try to do it the best you can.
And the Horned-Toed Derby kind of takes the cake for you?
Yeah, that was probably one of my biggest challenges.
And then you went from Fresno to San Francisco, of course, when Major League Baseball finally made it to the West Coast. We don't have time to talk about everything that you did in the major leagues and in the NFL, but do you have moments that you look back on and you say, you know what, that is what it was all about. That's what made it so worthwhile to me, and that's what I'm so proud of all these years later?
My biggest highlight of my career ever was 1960 at the Winter Olympics, because I broadcast, Franklin Muley had the rights to the English-speaking radio broadcasts, and several of us, Gordy Solthaw, Russ Hodges, me, and Russ's son, and we went up there to broadcast the Winter Olympics. We had a house that we all lived in together, and it was the party house for the Winter Olympics. After all the events were over, everybody came over to the house to have fun. Anyway, we had to broadcast everything. We had to broadcast the figure skating, speed skating, the slaloms, all that stuff. We broadcast. So try to think how you're going to broadcast a guy coming down the hill on the ski. But anyway, I broadcast the U.S. hockey games.
Mm-hmm.
And 1960 was the first year that the U.S. had defeated Russia and the first year that they'd won a gold medal. And since 1960, they've been just about forgotten. The 1980 team, they give them all these awards and everything. If I were on that 1960 team, I would say, wait a minute, what about us? We did it first. But it was the most exciting game. I've never seen an arena or anything where there was so much electricity involved, so much in it that it was just unbelievable. And talk about crying. Soltov was crying. He played hockey at Minnesota, and he was my expert on hockey. But he was, at the end of the game, he was crying because it was so unbelievable. I've never been involved in one Super Bowl, World Series, anything. I've gotten carried away, but not to that extent. It was the most remarkable sporting event I've ever done. And then they had to come back and win the next game to get the gold medal, the same way it was in 1980. After they beat Russia, they had to beat Finland, and they did. And so it was just a remarkable thing. And that was probably my highlight of my broadcasting career. That same year, I got the chance to do the telecast on the Final Four with California and Ohio State and Cincinnati, and I think NYU was in there.
Right. Some great ball players.
And Ohio State won it. I got to do that. So that was another. The Giants, 49ers, there were always some great games with the 49ers. And the same way with the Giants. And I got to meet a lot of wonderful people who are still great friends of mine, which certainly makes it very, very worthwhile.
I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about the origins of Tell It Goodbye and how it feels to be in the announcer's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Well, Tell It Goodbye, I don't know exactly how I came up with that phrase, but Russ said, bye bye baby, and I couldn't say that for a home run. His reason for saying bye bye baby was that if people were casually listening to the radio, they knew something good had happened for the Giants when they heard bye bye baby. So I decided I would say Tell It Goodbye, so that just sort of got in there, and then I added the way back stuff to it. The Hall of Fame was, it was something that I still don't believe I deserve. It was an honor, but it was one that was sort of muted by the fact that I didn't honestly feel that I was up and still don't feel that I was in that level of announcer. You can judge your own talents better than anybody else can judge them. And it's the way when I retired, I felt that when I had it, I would know it, and I did. I was making mistakes that I shouldn't make. I wasn't doing things that I thought I should do. So that's when I decided to quit. They said I could work there as long as I wanted, but that was as long as I wanted because I didn't think I was doing the job. And it was the same way. I don't put myself in the class with announcers like Scully and Hodges and Allen and people like that. They're in a different level. But it's nice to have the people in San Francisco vote for me and say that they enjoyed me. And so that was my pleasure that I got out of it, that the people in San Francisco had felt that I should be there.
Well, and I'm guessing if you've been listening today, you probably feel that way too. Lon Simmons, a voice we'll never forget. Another man who knew firsthand from his World War II Coast Guard service that freedom is not free. Normally that's the thought I leave you with, but this time, let's wrap up with one of baseball's best announcers describing a big moment from one of the greatest players of all time, complete with that signature finish.
Willie Mays up here drew a walk his first time. Runners at first and third with now one man out. A long high drive hit to left field. That one's going way back. Snyder back near the wall. Tell it goodbye.